Stars as Captain Kirk and Leonard Nimoy as Science Officer Spock on Star Trek in Color.
Your love of the halfling's leaf has clearly slowed your...
This is a little bit of a spin on a classic here. Instead of doing... We usually do high-low with, like, budget or box office, something like that. We're doing high-low with the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Mm.
But not necessarily the score itself, but I want higher or lower than... I'm going to give you higher or lower than other Star Trek movies in the franchise.
Yeah, I have no idea.
So the number is going to be 1.5. So basically... Is there zero or one movie rated higher than Galaxy Quest, or is there two or more rated higher than Galaxy Quest?
Do I get the number of Galaxy Quest? Like, do I know the tomato meter of Galaxy Quest, or am I kind of blind on that
too? Good. I think you get less points of our fictional points that don't mean anything. You get less points if you get the clue. Higher or lower than 1.5. It's like the over under 1.5. Is this the highest rated or second highest rated Star Trek movie ever made, or does it fit somewhere a little bit lower on the listing?
That's really good, McGee. I'm gonna give it to you. I think I want to know the tomato meter score. I'm gonna take less points to know the tomato meter score.
Okay. Fair enough. Because you are going in blind, not a big Star Trek head. But the tomato meter score for Galaxy Quest is 90%.
Really?
So a respectable 90%. Oh yeah, this was very well received when it came out.
Yeah, I'm reading. Y'all like this one. We'll get to that later on in the episode. I'm gonna say. It was 0 to 1 or 2 or more, right? I mean, those are kind of my options. So I'm going to say 0 to 1. Because I think the second one is probably the whichever one is the void, like the one Michael MJ uses for...
The Wrath of Khan with Shatner.
Yeah, I think that's like the highest rated one. And I think the ones that they're all kind of like lesser than, I want to say.
You are wrong on both counts.
Really?
There are two movies higher rated than Galaxy Quest in the Star Trek franchise.
I would have bet the fucking farm, the second one, was the one that everyone loves, and the rest of
it. So that's the crazy part, is the Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, 1982, starring William Shatner, which is like the iconic Star Trek film, is 87%, so is lower than Galaxy Quest. But Star Trek First Contact, 1996 with Patrick Stewart. And then 2009's J.J. Star Trek is the highest rated Star Trek movie.
You know, 94%. And as you were like two films, I was like, what other Star Trek? And then it hit the J.J. ones, hit me.
The J.J. Really? One. The J.J. sequel did not make the top of the list. It's like probably like fifth or sixth. But yeah, the 2009 Star Trek reboot and then First Contact are higher. But Wrath of Khan, weirdly lower.
Well, weirdly higher on this film. It's going to be a fun little chat. Actually, I have nothing for this.
Oh, I didn't set you up very well at all, but I'm going to take it. That's what we're going out to break with.
Welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, Captain Starshine himself, Sean McGee. What's going on with you, brother? How are you?
By Grabthar's hammer, what a podcast.
I wish there was a longer pause in there, because I think that the pause is what really
I'll put it in. I'll really milk the moment.
This is a show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You could be doing anything else with your time. We're so happy you're here with us. You can follow our socials in the show notes while scrolling down there. While scrolling down there, please rate, review, give us 5 stars, and support your local artists. Join us on Patreon for exclusive shows. We have some entertaining exclusives over there. McGee, what do you think people should be pairing with this film this week?
Well, not just because we were just talking about A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, both off mic and in last week's Shoot and Shit episode. But I think A Knight's Tale is a pretty good tonal pairing with this movie, where it's great respecting bit. The genre, having fun within the like bit of a satire, but like really the enjoyment comes from seeing people who really love it get to play in the space too.
And on today, yeah, I absolutely agree. I think we're going to be on interesting sides of this one. But I absolutely love, I love the pig.
He's going to take one of his iconic
bending zags
shithead positions where he can't enjoy people having fun.
We'll get to it. And on today's episode, we have McGee's pick for the week in 1999's Galaxy Quest. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling, and then dive into this film with our world famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind the scenes stories. So, without further ado, let's get into our review of 99's Galaxy Quest.
Own this best selling DVD. These actors,
by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you,
are now outer space heroes.
Look at where we are. We're in space.
Whoa.
It's the theatrical hit that gets two thumbs up from Roger Ebert and the movies.
I think we're the green thingy.
Oh, like you know.
And critics everywhere are calling it fast and funny. A hilarious blast.
They look like little children.
Hi, little guy.
Galaxy Quest is one great disc. Own it on DVD today.
All right, so that was from the trailer of 99's Galaxy Quest. Here's the log line. The alumni cast of the space opera television series have to play their roles as the real thing when an alien race needs their help. This is directed by Dean Parasot. This is photographed by Jerry Selinsky. This is written by David Howard and Robert Gordon. This is starring Tim Allen as Jason Nesmith, Sigourney Weaver as Gwen DeMargo, Alan Rickman as Alexander Dane, Tony Shalhoub as Fred Kwan. Sam Rockwell as Guy Flegman, Daryl Mitchell as Tommy Weber, and Enrico Calatoni as Mathazar. Old Enrico, one of those faces that you've seen in everything.
he is one of those guys for sure. You're like, oh, that guy.
Yeah, for sure. And first up in our exit interview section, this is going to be our general takes on the film. Starting at the start, McGee, it's not hard to tell why you made us watch this in our month of inside film or inside baseball films on film. Why are we watching this one today?
I mean, like you said, you know why. We're doing films about film. I felt like this was a fun choice for that because it's not your typical, like, people shouting, like, you know, an assistant director barking orders while an actress has a mental breakdown. And you get, like, a little bit of that kind of
my
jazz
choices,
of
mean?
It all. I don't think that they're bad for those reasons. I think that was me kind of trying to throw you the curveball of like presenting something where you thought I was going to pick something like that and ending up with something that was in that spirit, but ended up doing something unique and different. And this is such a just like crowd pleasing movie. Mm-hmm. I know this isn't necessarily something that is like either of us would be our first choice. Like neither of us are big Star Trek heads. Like I've tried to get into it and,
I would have bet some money you were a Trekkie. That's interesting to hear.
It would track. Like all the things are there for sure, but it just never bit me in the same way. So it wasn't something that I grew up with. It wasn't really anything I had any affinity towards. But this is just from an outsider's perspective, it feels true to the spirit. Like this is not something like you know that I'm intimately familiar with, but like. Obviously, it has the respect culturally as something that is like representational of the fandom at large and just like a solid movie prep, like just a good old fashioned fucking movie that like hits the notes. It does some of the characters like tropes better than the tropes that they're satirizing. Like, I think that this is probably one of the best examples of the like. Dumb guy captain actually being useful, better so than most versions of that character. Like almost every iteration of fucking Kirk, like reboot and classic, I think right situations for him to come out on top.
To dig into why that is for you, I really want to put a pin in that. Explore that a little later.
Yeah. We'll talk about it when we talk about like Tim Allen more in the post spoiler jump. But I think he does a really, for a guy that I I don't find charming in any way. He's just like
Tim.
Yeah, like don't get me wrong. There was a lot of Home Improvement on television when growing up, for sure. That's just one of those movies that was, or one of those TV shows that was just always on in the background, and it's never really funny, but it's always fucking on.
Yeah.
But like, so I have no love for Tim Allen.
Never really funny, but always on.
I think that was TBS's tagline for a while. I think Tim Allen is used just fucking perfectly here, where he's like annoying and schmoozy and shitty, but then really sells that he's able to like bring the character out in other people, and that's the value that he adds. Isn't anything that he really brings to the team himself, but he knows when to highlight somebody to make them more of themselves. Like he's a good leader in that way that I don't find leaders portrayed in cinema very often. It's usually like the one big heroic act or the like really smart play, but I think he lets other people shine in a way that I don't usually see leadership portrayed.
Okay, I like that. Yeah,
but so what about you? What's your horrendous take on this? No, I'm just kidding. But what was your reaction first watch?
I think the long and short of it is very much like Home Improvement. I don't find it offensive enough to turn off, but it wasn't enough of a turn on either. It didn't have enough of the things that I love about this genre of like actors becoming these parts that really kind of drew me. So while it didn't quite hit the mark, I do understand the appeal. I'm going to say some things in context that really lots of film, but by and large, I think I needed the story to dig in one level deeper to engage me past the half hour mark. And it plays on a superficial plane a little bit. It takes the crew from a cheesy sci-fi television show, and then there's like a one-to-one transfer of just placing them in that cheesy sci-fi scenario. And
yeah,
that's fine if that's what you want, and I'm not looking down on anybody for that, because I definitely have my very simplistic, superficial premises that I kind of ride with. This one just wasn't enough of my bag. It wasn't like it. What I write here? The one level deeper isn't out of orbit for me. I think like a year prior, like Hook, kind of has this, you know, same premise, like. Peter kind of becoming self-aware, like remembering why he grew up. Jingle All the Way was another one with Arnold, with like becoming Turbo Man, like teaches Arnold about the Christmas spirit. Tropic Thunder is one we'll get, you know, some years after this, where like the actors, they're still doing like the actor bit through the war film crisis. Birdman, you know, the superficial, like self-serious actor trying to like get away from his typecast. There's a little bit more meat on the bone when we hit these other films that I'm bringing up here, where I think the one-to-one transfer thing of just like taking the sci-fi characters and putting them in the sci-fi show with the same cheesy effects and I think I was waiting for like Tim Allen's going to learn. Like we had a setup of, I guess now I'm devolving into what I wanted to save into, but like we had a setup of Tim one, like he needs to feel self important. He hears the things in the bathroom that the kids are saying about him, and so we're almost on the hook of like this mission is going to give him that kind of self importance and that kind of like the thing that he needs. And so I think I was waiting for him to like kind of like learn there or get that, but we kind of abandon that premise, and then we just do the show. We do an episode of Galaxy Quest. While people are a little bit futzing around, and again, I get it, and this highlights the fandom of shows like that, that at this time in 99 were, you know, we didn't see them on screen, we didn't necessarily see the people who love these, you know, franchises, and them even become the heroes of the day, so I understand that being that appeal, but I'm in 2026 seeing this now, so I've seen this story done at a deeper level, or at least some more creative things, so I'm catching back up to like, oh shit, this is, in 99, this was the start of it. So I'm definitely here with you guys, but I wanted to, please, it feels like you want to react to some of that.
I do. I think you're right. I think that there was something that I was hanging on to that I had a criticism of it that I'll get into like specifically later in studio notes. But I think that for the large part, most of the smaller like characters' arcs work, but the like main arc doesn't really tie back in with anything very well.
I
think I'm realizing that some of my criticisms all kind of orbit around that thread, as it were.
Right.
That I do think that is a weakness of the movie for sure.
Yeah, and not I don't want to hang up on that because I for that first half hour or so, like after Tim gets back for the first time, I guess, and I'm really kind of I'm gonna get less out of spoilers here, but that half hour mark, I'm like, oh, okay, this is a really good setup, and I really like when you hear the premise, you're like, that's a brilliant premise. I could see so many different scenarios, but I think for my palate, we just didn't get to that second deeper level of the story.
Yeah, I don't think it was woven together as tight as it could have been.
Right.
Like you said, maybe if it cooked another draft or two to really like bring everything up into the finale, as it were, or really just like kind of weave it all together more throughout it. I think it would have really been more brought it on that level. Yeah,
absolutely. So not offensive. There's definitely some funny moments in the first. And even I shouldn't even just say throughout the film, there are some really hilarious like bits that happen. But it plays it a little straight. And you know, the one to one cheesy low budget parodying. I just wanted just a little bit more. And that framework, though, they do highlight the abrasive fandom, which I think is great. Justin Long, doing this, I think is really fucking great. You know, just like his first little, you know.
Baby Justin Long.
Right? I think the Poe's performances of Kellatoni and company as Mathazar and his crew, I think they really do some great physical comedy with just how they move.
Yeah.
Even small react, like when the slight spoilers the first 12 minutes of the film, but in a shot for shot we'll talk about a little later on, where he's like, help me look for my pants, and you could tell in their reverse shot that they all kind of they all thought about like what would an alien not knowing anything about pants or something like that, where they would look or something.
They're
like
all looking on the ceiling for it. It's very good. Funny.
And there are,
you know, that was all the alien mannerism stuff was Enrico.
Yeah, he was the first audition and, like, and kind of set the tone.
And then they were
just
like, just do what he's doing.
That's got to feel pretty great in an audition, too.
Right,
I'm going to take what you just did there, and now everybody has to play against
that. That is the language of the movie now. Thank you.
So there are many earlier faces that are really prominent. That, you know, really prominent down the line, that's really fun to see pop up here. And again, the central conceit, I think, is incredible. So there are many ways to sort of spin this. It didn't necessarily spin it in the way that I think that I wanted it to get there. So this is a little bit of the case of me wanting the movie being something that it's not. But I don't think it's totally unfair, because I think it sets up a premise where I'm like, oh, I thought that's where we were going. Like almost a joke that you could just like, oh, I thought that was a joke you were telling. And then the punchline wasn't exact. It was like, oh, the setup was so great. Oh, I wanted the punchline to be a little sharper for me, for my taste. I thought Alan Rickman Alan Rickman had a great quote that sort of surmises my thoughts on the movie. He says about the movie, or at least something about the tone they were asking him about, where he says, quote, "The fact that the logo didn't change from the call sheet to the poster was a sign," end quote, from Alan Rickman. And he was a big fan of it moving forward, but I just thought that quote was hilarious in terms of...
incredible. That's talk about inside baseball. Way to be on fucking theme. That's the most inside baseball ass fucking thought I've ever heard, and it's incredible. What a fucking genius.
I heard that. Holy shit. Let me write this. I gotta tell McGee. That's hilarious.
That's awesome. I love that so much. I was gonna say, when you brought up Tropic Thunder in your breakdown, I was like, oh, yeah, Ben Stiller's absolutely somebody who had this on the shelf for sure.
Yeah.
And did anybody else spring to mind for you for who might have this Blu-ray on the shelf?
I did. Yes, I did. Jerry Katzenberg, for those in the know. He's a big power player at Disney for a while before breaking off with him, Spielberg, and Geffen to start DreamWorks. That's with the SKG at the in the DreamWorks header meant that point in time. He didn't put any effort into the marketing of this at all for Dean Pearsall.
So he was like,
and so when the first week it made X amount of money. I think it was going against like Stuart Little, and there's another big film in 99. Maybe it was Toy Story that weekend. I can't remember what it was.
You know, Stuart Little was written by M. Night Shyamalan.
I thought he did Punch-Ups.
Is he the he's credited on the screenplay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there's another writer on it, but yeah.
Yeah.
I just learned that recently. Okay. And was like, wait, what the fuck?
There's another one.
And She's All That, I think, was the other one. Anyway.
Was that it? Because I wanted to say, they said PTA recently for something else, too. Like, he did Punch-Ups on the screen. You're like, really, huh? You were working on that. But yeah, anyway. So
one of those guys?
So I went with Katzenberg just because on the second week, I guess this film makes more money than the first week. The word of mouth and the fandom sort of spread, and you know, it makes a little bit more money. And then he calls, you know, Dean Parasot, the director of this, and just says, kind of apologizes for not promoting the film. This is during the holidays, too. Don't fucking call me in the second week, Katzenberg. It sort of apologizing for not promoting my film. So I was a Katzenberg had it on the shelf, but you know, that's a call you can just miss me with that one.
Like 6 months from now or whatever, you know, like would do that when
put
you get your
$15 million into give me another poster, give me another billboard somewhere off of La Brea or something like that. Like fucking put some money
I
into
assume
it.
If he's calling him in week two that he's also putting some money into it. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but
yeah, I don't need a fucking call, dog. give me some money into this.
Some money into this. I'll take the ego stroking any day.
All right, let's get to the film's Big Bang. Speaking of strokes, huh? Let's get to the film's Big Bang after this.
Oh, do you want to do scene each show?
Oh, shit. My mind was already with the transition. McGee, what scene would you show before we go out? Scene each show to get somebody to watch here. A lot of fun. This is the movie built around scenes, trailer scenes, crowd-pleasing kind of scenes. Yeah, which one did you go with?
I think for the emotional peak and valley of it, the like wild swinging between the like epic sci-fi and the comedy, and like, obviously slight spoilers, but the scene when they first take out the ship.
Same scene.
Yeah. Oh, it's the best representation. It's about 32 minutes in. It's when Tim Allen turns to Tommy Daryl Mitchell's character and tells him to take her out. The look on his face when he realizes that everybody is waiting on him to fucking...
It's how long the drift happens for, too. Because, like, everyone's...
Everyone
all
leans.
In almost real time. And I've been in these scenarios to where you're, like, handing a little bit more machinery than you're capable of doing. You're just trying to hold it together. And then I love that we cut into... What are they, the Thormines or the Thormines or something like that?
Thermians, I think.
Thermians. Like, they all kind of, like, back up from the window, too. So there's, like, a real quick shot from inside where they're all kind of backing up as it's hitting the side of the plane of the window and shit like that. The sound design. Like, this is what I thought we were going to get more of. I want to put a pin in this, but I do appreciate the cheesy sci-fi, just throw them in that episode, and that's kind of the bit. But I thought we were going to get more of... this kind of thing, like the actor doing the thing, and it's kind of awkward, it's kind of silly. I'll explain a little bit more what I mean later on, but like here, this is what I'm saying, like the first half hour mark, this is where I'm like, okay, this is a funny premise. I love this fucking scene of him taking it out, and it just didn't hit the highs for me.
Yeah. The one thing I think that this scene does so well, though, the look on his face when he like first grabs the controls, like it really, like that feeling of like you said, like being a little in over your head, but the moment before the horror when you're just excited for it, or maybe like the moment after the horror where you've like kind of gotten in the groove a little bit, like there is the moment when he's playing with the controls where you really feel the awe of it in a way that I think when it really works in stories where you have that like fish out of water element where the actor is getting to be the person who is experiencing this amazing moment as a completely new foreign feeling. So he gets to really just like crank that dial up all the way. And it just makes it hit that much better for the audience where it just is like, oh, I want to fly a fucking spaceship. That looks fucking awesome. like more so than like anything in Star Wars, because they just are like, they hop in and they boop boop boopy and grab, right, you know, and take off, and it just doesn't have any friction to it in the same way, right, that, pun intended, yeah, that this scene does.
I am Electro, mightiest of all.
Oh, listen, we don't have much time. The algorithms, they're too strong. They're coming for us. Our take's too hot. Our swag too different. It's all up to you now. Make Me Watch needs you. We need you to send an episode to a friend. Yes, you. Do it. We can't rely on the machines anymore. We have to grow the old-fashioned way. One by one.
All right, we're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be fully spoiling the film, starting with the start in the Big Bang, appropriate as ever for this movie, and the galaxies and the stars. So does this opening sizzle or fizzle? What'd you think?
I think it sizzles. I think the everything about the tone, the shift in aspect ratio is fitting. I think everyone gets an immediate type to play against. So you see, once you realize this isn't, you know, if you're going into this blind at all and you thought this was going to be an actual big budget sci-fi kind of Star Trek epic, and we immediately kind of shift in tone and we see, hey, this isn't the stalwart leader. This isn't the... I don't know, the alien that's enthused, the stoic alien that's cool with being the second and sort of enthused about the role. You know, everyone has a type that they can play against. The child isn't a child, a naive sort of smiling child in this one anymore. He's got anger, he's kind of volatile in this point, and he's upset at Captain Kirk in this instance. So I think it all kind of works, the personal, interpersonal dynamics. My favorite line of the film comes from within this first 5 minutes. So this is gonna be really fucking funny. But I like the opening, and I was on board. I really was. Even with some of the and this is going a little past this part. This like the convention, like some of the cheesier, more forced bits, the screenwriting bits where you can like see the hand and sort of like force the plot to kind of get there.
Yeah,
I'm riding along with it. I think it's kind of fun and funny. So I was locked in with this this first like 10-15 minutes. What about you?
There's a little bit of the hand of the screenwriter, especially in the opening like convention scene. Mm-hmm. I think the first scene, like you said, like going with the aspect ratio change, and then immediately into the like backstage inside baseball stuff of these like actors just dreading going out and for the public appearance. I know, you know, people who have volunteered at like cons and stuff to like shepherd around celebrities between these appearances, and it just sounds like absolute hell. I can't imagine. I can't imagine it's fun for anyone, but to also be trying to deal with a failed career, as is our ethos on this podcast, it's just the combination of things just sounds absolutely like its own special breed of torture. So I do like the tone of this opening is fun. I think in the convention itself, my only like real main issue is the him overhearing the conversation in the bathroom, which is more so because it doesn't pay off structurally in the like overall arc of the movie. Yeah. I think is why that stands out as it bothers me. Mm-hmm. It's not so much as it by itself as it's like lack of payoff that's really frustrating.
So moving into compliment sandwich, because I want to spring off that, the bread for me is ultimately like, I do love the conceit of this, but I wish, you know, in getting into the meat, that it captured more of the actor's experience in that way. I wish it was like Tropic Thunder is going to be the successor to this, and to where it's like really, yeah, diving into like actors, like when I say quote unquote actors with a capital A, like talking about hidden marks and, you know, other takes and shit like that, like they're doing the actor thing. And I thought that's kind of what we were going to do, along with teaching these aliens either performance or to be more themselves or to like fit it, whatever it was. Like, I thought we were, the natural build on this was, okay, so they on the face of it are actors that don't seem like they're going to be right for this, but in somehow they're the Stanislavski method or staying in character works for you.
You were looking for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking for the too. Yeah, the hook,
so you and want to tie it together.
Yeah, and it just didn't get there for me, so I was getting a little like, "Oh, okay, this is different." This is just they're in the I guess we're just in the episode, which is again, it's enough for some people, obviously, and I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, but for me, I think the setup in my head is I'm trying to like think 20 pages ahead. I'm like, "Oh, I see what we're about to do." And it didn't land there for me. So,
yeah. You know. No, I think I agree for sure.
Do you have Time Machine or Priest Buddhist? Cut both of those, this one?
I guess I could do my Time Machine, and we'll see if I keep it.
Grover Cleveland's president of the Time Machine. I'll give him your regards.
So, does this movie work in a different decade? It's kind of perfect already. There's some stuff I read about. They had a sequel kind of prepped and ready to go, and then Alan Rickman passed away, and they pulled the plug because they were just like, there's no doing it without him. Like, that was a pretty key. Mm-hmm. You just can't break up the band on this one. Mm. But so this is less of a time machine and more of a multiverse. But there were some other people considered for the role. And I want you to tell me I'm going to say four names. One of them is real. You tell me which one you think is the one that was actually associated with this movie.
Okay. I think I know this, to be honest with you, so I'm curious.
Oh, do you already know this one?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because they offered it. They had a big fight about, Kevin Kline, eventually they were going to sign off of it with when Harold Ramis was a part of it. I don't want to step.
I'm just going to cut this then, because you already know all the fucking answers.
I do like it though. Let's talk about it. Like in Time Machine, because I'm not as convinced as you that Alan was the immediately best right person for the role. And Dean Prescott obviously thought, because I think somebody like I think I needed somebody even to ham it up even a little. Oh, that's not fair. Because Tim's doing a lot. Well, Tim's doing the drunken stupor thing, and like the limo shit too is really fun. I know we're getting into a little bit of acting shit, but he's like hitting on
he's like, hey, where are you from? What's your name?
Like, and he's doing all that. Like, he's really endearing in that way. What do I want? I don't know. There's some other names. Let's talk about them. Kevin Kline could have been interesting. I think that could have been that could have been a really interesting choice. There was one more.
Steve
there was
Martin
one.
Attached that I was like, I really wanted to know who Steve Martin was supposed to be. I wonder if they were going to go with Steve Martin as one of the aliens or like as the main one.
Yeah.
Which would have been a get. That. Would have been fucking incredible.
I could see that. There was another.
Oh yeah, the other one. Unfortunately, is Alec Baldwin, who regrettably
I did see Alec Baldwin. And that's,
I will. Yeah, I know. 30 Rock. Yeah. Fuck Alec Baldwin, but like pre 30 Rock Alec Baldwin, it's a smart choice for this
role.
Because
I could see him doing more. Like I needed a more self aware take, maybe, or like, because I could see him doing the real eyes slanted kind of like. Chin up, chest out, like really kind of doing like he's doing his the 30 yeah. Rock thing, you know, like he's doing
I think if he basically just played like Jack Lemmon a decade younger, then that would have worked perfect. I think it was a solid choice, even though you know, fuck Alec Baldwin.
Join Jackie and Danielle, two best friends and ex-Blockbuster employees who are rewatching some of their favorite movies from the late 90s and early 2000s on the No More Late Fees podcast. And remember, be kind and rewind.
All right, welcome back from break. We're going under the lights, breaking down performances. Starting up here with the best performance, I want to give some love to Enrico Colatoni, who's been everywhere. Yeah. I know him most as Keith Mars from Veronica Mars. Veronica Mars is dead.
You were a big Veronica Mars.
Not even that. It was my roommates. We were into that.
Yeah,
we used to have I literally knew nothing about it.
Hey, you want to know what I know him most from? What? Is Just Shoot Me, the awful sitcom.
Never saw
that. Was like it's a sitcom, like a workplace comedy about fashion photography. Like studio?
Is that what that was about?
Or
I remember
like a
the
fashion
name,
magazine.
But I never
I think they're fashion magazine. It's awful. It's an awful, awful show. I don't know why my parents watched it or why it was always on television, but I've definitely... I can't entirely blame it on them. I probably watched some of it, too. I worked for a fashion company for a long time. It might be formulative. But yeah, that's what I know him from.
He's... I think he's great here as Mathazar. I think the bit is definitely geared towards, and they gear this film towards a younger audience. So some of this stuff is broad. You know, they're not allowed to be as weirdly, you know, grotesque or specific in some areas that I think could have been really funny. But the voice plays really well. I think the walking marionette thing is really funny as well. I like a lot of the performances across the board. Some of the writing, I feel like, harms some of the performances, though. I'll be honest with you. Like, I wanted more for Sigourney. I truly did. Like, she
bats so far above the material that she's given. It's tough.
And that line
And they tried to even cut the stuff that she was given.
Really?
The studio was still, like, every single decent moment that she gets as a character, they tried to be like, this isn't working in the edit. And she was like, absolutely not. Like,
because I don't think they just, it's not working in the edit because they didn't give her enough on the page. I'm going to just assume. Because there's like, and this is what I kind of mean about some of the writing. So while I do up top in your breakdown, I absolutely agree that some of the side characters even get more of arcs, or they get, you know, more of some meat on the bone than even Tim himself. But I think Sigourney, was a recipient of the worst of it, because her bit of, you know, I'm just the bimbo that's, you know, talking to the computer, my job is really stupid. I think that's a good launching point, but I need you to dig into that arc more so that when we're in the later part of the film, it's not just like, because that line to me is really painful of, you know, my job is stupid, but I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah. So like, it's just like, there's nothing for her to do. Like, there's no reason even for her to get that excited about it, because there's nothing for that. In the reality of the film, that person getting excited about that and just doing it over and over just doesn't even really make sense. I know we're in a broad comedy and a children's comedy, but I needed something like, this maybe needed to be the joke of the existential weird shit, or like, what does it mean to talk to a computer, or does a computer have feelings and am I sharing those, or is there we needed to give her something that makes it not just the bimbo thing, so that she has a reason to get excited about it. But please,
I totally agree with everything that you're saying. I think that everything presented would work if it had a moment of payoff at the end. It's just like the thing I was complaining about with like the Tim Allen listening to the guys talk shit about him too. It's the same feeling of like, she has these really profoundly sad moments that need to come to a resolution and just don't really.
Right.
Where it, like, and I think that I love the, my head when you were talking about her like with the computer's like personality, like has feelings or whatever, like if it was like the ship had an AI that would only deal with her because she talked to it like a person, and like everybody else just treated it like an object, but she was like had a real
person, which is
like
what she's going through, right? Like that's her, like people so her, I like think, an odd like oh there's a the, lot of the, you know,
I think that's, you could have,
like, I needed to dig one level deeper, dude, like
that's
like
fair.
One level,
you know,
deeper
what?
In the script, dog. Like
I'm defending this script, and then we just had to like fix such a thing in such a minimal effort that it's like, oh no, yeah, maybe.
But again, for 99, I think we're in 2026 talking about this, and so we've had you know, odd X amount of years to sort of like, oh shit, like this is how you can.
And
really
they're also fighting the shitheads that were not even promoting the movie. Like,
right.
Those are the guys who are giving them the notes that Sigourney's having to fight for even the personality that she is allowed to show in the movie, and they're even trying to take that away from her. Like, and it and they undoubtedly would have if it was somebody with less clout than Sigourney fucking Weaver.
Right.
Which is like, why is she in this movie? She's
That's
so
what
good.
I wanted to ask you. I was like, why is Sigourney in this? But
I don't know. I think nobody just says no to her. Like, if Sigourney wants to be in your movie, you're just like, yeah, I will put you in this fucking movie. This rule. It's like why she's in Avatar 2 as like a kid again. Because James Cameron was like, yeah, I'm going to keep working with you. This fucking rips.
And at that point in time, obviously, she's Ripley. So, and I know part of the ethos of Dean casting for the film is he wanted to see faces that hadn't been in sci-fi, or we hadn't seen in sci-fi films. Obviously, Ripley would, you know, betrays that ethos immediately.
Because when Sigourney Weaver says, yeah, sure, I'll be in your movie, you go, yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am.
And she had a good time. And she was one of the, you were saying up top, and what I'm getting a rap for is not wanting actors to have fun on sets. But she did this, I think, strictly because she wanted to have fun as, like, the bimbo starlet kind of thing. And she brings that up as, what, like, keeping the wig afterwards. They made her, you know, a prosthetic chest, you know, breastplate for some of these shots in there. Like, she really kind of wanted to dive in this. That's just one example. The other, you know, there's like Tony Shalhoub is another one to where it's like, I love me some Tony Shalhoub. And that's kind of why I want to keep American Myths, because the movie I want to show you has the most amazing Tony Shalhoub performance in it.
Oh, hell yeah.
But like for him, it's like the alien romance, like in him being high, like it never really coalesced for me. I'm like, I don't understand your function.
No, but
really.
I love his take that he's just gonna be totally fine with everything.
Well, yeah, awesome.
That's
take.
Fucking incredible.
Right.
We're like, that was one of my alternate open. If you knew the Rotten Tomatoes thing already, I was gonna just say, like, you know, what character do you identify with the most in this movie? Because for me, 100%, it's Tony Shalhoub's character.
Yeah.
Where in my heart of hearts, everybody else would be panicking, and I would just be going, "Oh wow, oh cool."
I'm gonna have to go with my boy. This is just not a black thing, but Daryl Mitchell as the ship pilot. I really connected to. But this is a perfect segue into Multiverse Casting Couch of Madness, alternate roles, because there was somebody an alternate pick for Daryl that I think would have been. Like, I honestly think it would have set this cast on fire. Can you guess? It's actually a pick I've had. You know, no, I'm not even going to let you guess, because you're just going to go Eddie, and we're going to get some Eddie shots in here, and I'm going to be upset the rest of the episode. I would just
you're protecting it. Yourself.
I would just spoil it and say David Alan Greer. Visit us in our Jumanji episode was it, like, wasn't it? Like, that would have been him and Tim Allen played off each other. I was like,
he's a little too old, I think. He wouldn't really play like grown up kid. The joke, wouldn't be the same as him being young,
right?
But that's a one off joke. I think the net positive that you had gained from David Alan Greer, like, no shade to our man that played the role, because he was great as well. But I think David Alan Greer is an inspired choice that would be an excellent addition to the cast.
I think he would have brought a little bit more to the overexcitedness of, like, trying to deal with Tim Allen that I would appreciate.
And the be able to kind of, like, have that, like, tete-a-tete with him.
Yeah.
Where he's trying to act like a captain, and it's just like, motherfucker, we're both actors. Like,
right.
You don't get to bark orders at me, man.
Yeah. It would have been, because I think Alan, he takes a little bit of the load off of Alan, Rickman, I'm talking about, like, in terms of, like, trying to bring Alan down to size a little bit, like, trying to check his ego in a little bit way. So,
So I have a multiverse game for you as well, taking a little different route. What I want to know is, what fucking legendary bomb did Tim Allen avoid by committing to this project?
Oh, there was a sliding doors moment. That's another thing. Oh, okay. So what was it?
He was committed to another project.
I read this.
And turned it down and decided to do Galaxy Quest. So when I tell you the movie, you're going to know what the answer is.
Oh, I have a multiple choice? Okay, cool. Yeah.
All right. So we'll go A, Wild Wild West, speaking of Kevin Kline. Mm-hmm. It's around the same time. You know, it was almost almost a sliding doors moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, B, Bringing Out the Dead. Maybe Marty was looking to get an unhinged role. You know, he's got the fucking
now narc, you're making me second guess myself.
He's got the narc cokehead arrest on his under his belt. He definitely fits in.
Fucking rat. Uh-huh.
I like that didn't come up until now. I had to sneak it in there. You got C, Bicentennial Man. Oh! We talked about Robin Williams earlier. Yeah, and he knew. That's I knew once I said the answer, he was going to click it. And then just the D, you don't even know that this movie existed, because I didn't know this movie existed. But I thought it was going to throw you off if you didn't already know the answer. For Love of the Game, which is a Sam Raimi, Kevin Costner baseball movie that nobody watched.
No, I didn't see it. But I think I didn't see that. That's right. That's why I wanted to remember that, because Bicentennial Man was going to be a pick. It was going to be a Christmas pick for you. Have you seen
My God, you're one. No, I have not watched Bicentennial Man.
All right, so this movie is actually really, really special to me. And I watched it earlier last year. I hope
I don't hate it.
You will. You absolutely will. Because me going back and revisiting it, I was like, oh, I don't know. That's why I didn't pick it. But there's a line in Bicentennial Man that me and my brother will repeat to each other ad nauseum as kids. So I wanted to bring it up because it's the funniest fucking Robin Williams line in the back. But I'll get into it. But yes, I did see. I can't imagine. I guess it depends on the role, because Robin ended up taking on the movie, but I can't imagine Tim is like the android cyborg alien.
And like Tim doing like an Oscar bait movie is hilarious. Like the idea of him trying to be totally dead fucking serious for 120 a goddamn Earth minutes. That it's just I could not imagine it working. I thought Wild Wild West would have been an inspired choice, though. I was pretty happy with that as one of my fake answers.
See, the thing is, Kevin Kline's too strongly. I would associate that more with Kevin Kline than as far as like.
Yeah, I thought
the
maybe
role,
the revolving door thing would get you.
Yeah,
like
he could have got it with,
considered
oh,
for this role.
There. Okay.
They kind of swap
you
movies.
You were digging one level deeper in there. You were creating like the reality around it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Bringing out the dead almost got you though. That was a.
Was it Nick or was it him? I can't tell. Speaking of which, let me talk about best line reads of this film.
Speaking of lines.
This absolutely fucking kills me. So I've watched it twice in both fucking versions. As within the first 20 or first 2 minutes of the film, and it's when we're bringing out Alan Rickman, and he's like, he's already done this. You know, I swear to God, I won't say the line again. Blah blah blah. But like, as he's on stage, and it's Sam Rockwell off camera, off mic, or I'm sorry, on mic, off camera. But like, as you know, by the hammer, what was it, the Gabathar's hammer?
Grabthar's hammer, or something. I think it's Grabthar.
So we've already established that, you know, he's the thespian in the group. So when this like moment happens, it's humiliating to even add a little bit, like pour some salt in the wound. I love Sam Rockwell off camera going, "This guy can act." He's like, "Oh my God, that kills me." Just like the silent under the crowd clapping, like, yeah, this guy can act. It's just like, it makes me laugh so fun.
That's not the line I thought you were going with at all. That's hilarious. I love the way that the line, like the iconic tagline, he's avoiding it and it just plays over the speakers and the life just draining from his face as he realized he even got the choice taken away from him to even say the line.
But I think
it's just so perfect. But yeah, I didn't even notice Sam Rockwell.
But then reminding, like, or having this, like, fucking putz remind you that you've had some like, classical training in this moment.
Oh, he can act. Oh, my God. Sam Rockwell's so fucking good in this movie, dude. Every one of his like rants is so incredible. Genuine fear.
Let me ask you this, because I like it, but there's some bits that I wasn't really sure what we were doing with his character. This is the Dean. You love to blame the director. I'm actually going to blame Dean on some of this. Some of it was like I couldn't tell what we were doing with Guy. Like his personality wasn't as defined as like, so he's explosive, I'm going to die at any moment kind of character. But there would be bits like when Enrico showed the security footage of the dude being like torn to pieces, but like Guy's the only one that's like into it. And so he's like, if you go back to there's a cutaway, I think he's sitting next to, I can't remember, either Sigourney. I think he's sitting next to Sigourney. He's like everyone else is like recoiling at it, and then he's the only one that's like staring at it, like kind of like smiling. And then the next cut is he's like super worried about it. Like he's like, oh my god, we can't go down the plank. I'm getting there, so there's a lot of or like there's one point in which he's like staring at her tits while they're talking, like and like purposely so. Like he's like it's not like like Sam Rockwell's actor is getting caught on camera, but
yeah,
like, the character is like only like staring at her. And then the next cut. I can't even remember what happens with it. I just remember that bit of like, why is he staring at her? Like, why are we making a bit out of this and the security camage or security camera footage? There's like three or four of those throughout the film where I'm like, I'm not sure what we're doing with Guy. That is a Dean bit.
I think Sam Rockwell's just improvising
a lot of that, right? And but as a director, I'm like, you got to rein some of that. You got to rein some of this in. At least get this on the same wavelength. Because I'm like, he's going in a lot of places here. He's making a lot of choices. And you're taking a lot of, you know, you're answering a lot of them in the edit. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why we're putting this all in for the cut.
Fair enough. I don't mind it. I love a goofy Sam Rockwell picture. But I don't think you're wrong that there's a little bit of inconsistency there. But it's just a good old time. I love the like obvious we cut this to be PG, where they've like there's so certain lines that are dubbed over because they were like, oh shit, yeah, we were gonna go for a harder rating and then decided to, at the last minute, to pull the plug.
It works for you. You liked the bit because it how awkward it feels. Oh, or it works for you.
No. I'm just like I'm saying like that kind of can I think. That element of it kind of just makes the whole thing feel like they were finding it in the edit a little bit, where to me, that's just like, it's the movies, baby. Like, I don't mind it because I kind of like the art and the craft of it, where you love a pen. You like have a very like writer's forward background. Like, I kind of love jazz. I don't like to, you know, have as much structure. Right. Not like you don't like jazz. You know what I'm saying. Like I like the chaos of it a little bit more, and like trying to find the beauty in the chaos and like come up with something out of what you're able to get. So like I'm a little bit more forgiving on elements like that.
Some of the chaos in there, Sigourney says in lieu of what you're saying, like they had to re-record some of the stuff to make it child friendly, kid friendly. Was the whatever the smashing of the
Just goes like. What did she say? She's just like, fuck that. Or
she just fuck that, I think, on set. And then the ADR, she does, I can't even remember what the line is. Forget that, or...
Yeah, it's a really bad... It's up there with pretty bad ones, where I was like, let's duck that. Yeah. that's better than what they did.
But she does mention she brought this up in one of the making ofs or talking about it years later, that she purposely says the line in an awkward way to, you know, I don't think a stab at the producers or whoever was forcing her to redo this.
Yeah.
Because they liked a lot of the, you know, the more rated PG-13 R stuff that they were doing on set that they didn't, you know, kind of get away from. I wish they would have, would you have been turned off by that? Like, do you think as a kid... Don't you want a little bit of something like that? Like maybe an F-bomb or two to slip in a PG-13, I guess. Does this harm the film, do you think, if they really keep some of those elements?
I think that it kind of places it... Like, I mean, I'm not one to side with directors meddling very often, incredibly almost never, I would say. But this is a case where...
You mean
where,
the directors
like,
of the film? What? What?
No, I said like producer meddling.
Oh, you said like, director. You definitely.
Yeah, did I? Oh, I meant to say
you said directors meddling. I was like, wait, what?
I don't like directors meddling in their own films. They need to give up control to the money makers. No, producer meddling. My bad. Like, yes, but in this case, I do think this kind of positions it uniquely as like there's so many satires that are just raunchy satires. Is like that's kind of the most common combination of like an adjective with the word satire. So I think it does kind of put it in a unique position as like it is kind of kid friendly. Yeah. I actually one of the things I was thinking of like for Grover Cleveland or one of the other bits was like, is there another? Because I don't think you can really do a sequel to this without the OG cast at this point. Like they're just kind of this premise in sci-fi is this movie. like you said, Tropic Thunder kind of picks up the ball with it and runs and like focuses really on the actor side of the inside baseball element. But I wonder if there's another like, you know what isekai is? Like the, like it's like a category of anime that is, the protagonist is a real world kid that gets dropped into a new world. Like a fantasy world or a sci-fi world or whatever. It's just like you're a regular human on Earth in the modern day that gets sucked up from home and dropped in a new fantasy land. That's like isekai stories. Okay. So this is definitely like isekai. And so I was just thinking, like, what's another genre that could take this kind of like isekai story and do a satire and run with it? Like my mind obviously went to D&D, where I think obviously the most recent D&D movie I loved. We have an episode about it. Go listen to it. But I would have loved to see a D&D movie that was more of a genre satire, where there is the kind of meta narrative.
Noir, theft, robbery.
Oh, I mean, like the meta level of like, the characters are being controlled by players at a table is like
a Lego kind of thing.
Yeah, so exactly. So because like the nature of the narrative in tabletop games is largely driven by the fact that it's four people getting drunker around a table that are trying to make each other laugh. So your characters do dumb, risky shit that logically human beings in a world would never do. But, like, you're trying to have a good time. You're playing a fucking game. So you're going to do dumb shit with your characters because they're toys. And so, like, some of it you're, like, trying to make narrative sense. It's, like, what makes sense for your character. But sometimes you're just trying to get a laugh out of your boys that are sitting at the table with you. And, like, I think that, to me, is so core to the spirit of D&D that I think doing, like, an isekai story where you're, like, dropping players of a game into the world of the game and making them kind of have their meta. I mean, I'm sure like the Minecraft movie did something like this, but I don't know. I didn't watch it.
And but, I think like Jumanji, I was gonna kind of sprung to mind a little bit too. I think some
especially the more recent like remakes ones.
That's what I mean. Like the newer ones where they're like kids in the real world and then they become their digitized character selves.
I didn't watch those movies either. I'm not gonna lie.
I'm basing this all on the trailer. So like they show one kid is this way and the next he's Kevin Hart or something like that in the next game.
That's what I assume the premise is.
Yeah. The second they all switch characters or they're like Kevin Hart's now Dwayne Johnson or some shit like that. Like they all kind of so there's a little bit of that what you're talking about. So I could see a version of that with Galaxy Quest for sure. Let's talk about and we can just hang that there. Best fit or did you have a?
I forgot to get a best fit. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, we could just all the Sigourneys.
Yep.
Just her slowly deteriorating costume.
We were saying like other. How do I say this? If we're gonna do a multiverse on Sigourney, it feels like there's some other people that could have taken on the bimbo kind of like, or the how do we add a little bit more gravitas? Like Jennifer Coolidge, I want to say was thinking about this is Stifler's mom.
Yeah,
she was
she's fucking hilarious. She would have been excellent in the role for sure.
Yeah,
she would have been dialed up the bimbofication of it. I think, and also she would have been fucking hilarious. I think Sigourney Weaver brings that like overqualified element to it that I really love, where it's like this is a woman who should be doing so much more, but is forced to just like have her tits fall out every episode. And I think that's
kind of bit of that with Alan Rickman, but I do see it with if we're going to do the Sigourney falls in love with the computer like version of the film that we were writing.
That would be really funny with Jennifer Coolidge. That would really be really fucking funny. God, I really want to see this version. I didn't think that we would have a good alt pitch, but this is a really good alt pitch.
Our OnlyFans slate only grows. Let's talk about some of the shots of the film coming up in our Behind the Lens segment after this.
So, which 6 minutes should we cut?
Ooh.
Jeff's death scene, probably, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, what about your steel drum solo?
Oh, I don't think we should lose that.
Well, what about the weird wedding ritual on Glipglop's planet, huh?
Okay. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater.
We're not cutting a frame of Glipglop. I mean, that's like cutting Cowboy out of Midnight Cowboy.
Ash, your podcaster of choice at Once Weekly Make Me Watch is right for you. Proven to reduce time spent ambling through streaming services and alleviate dull commutes. Follow along our Shot for Shot segment on your social media platform of choice with links provided in the show notes. Make me watch.
You will.
Contact us if you observe any of the following reactions upon exposure: an overwhelming desire to suggest a film, a burning need to correct our pronunciation, or excessive pocket change. Special thanks to Nick and Jay Shute, Mike from Failing Hollywood, and Adam from Pop It Together. Additional music provided by Kevin MacLeod. Full credits in the show notes below.
All right, we're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and curtain close. As always, there's a link in the show notes to our Patreon where you can check out our favorite shots in this segment. It's a free post on Patreon. You don't have to sign up to see it, but you should while you're there. This is Shot for Shot. Our favorite shot we have, as often happens, the same shot in this one.
Same shot.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I like this a lot. This is the Alan Awakens. We have him in a tight close-up, and we're like shooting through the corner of a glass table. His POV is, and as we cut into his POV, it's of a wide of the alien sort of hunching, peering in from the sliding glass door outside. There's a bit about shooting through glass and then showing his POV through glass. I just kind of like these, you know, these perspective choices, and I think the bit is really funny. And as the motivation of the camera, like we actually have a motivated lift here, and as we do this lift, we have the group kind of like their posture sort of straighten up in this. So I like the feeling of this movement, and then the changing of their postures against Tim sort of rising up. And I think it's really funny as we cut out back to the wide of Tim sort of in his underwear, sleeping on the floor, but he's like, he hunches and kind of like starts wiping his eyes. I think it's just like a funny bit in that wide, comedy played in that wide, that works really well. And then again, shooting through glass, and then we're ending this scene kind of as he's sliding the glass door. There's this motif of glass that I like a lot. It's particularly as we have this strong glass in the foreground of the motivated lift that works really well for me. Well, what is it about this shot that you like?
That's what I wanted to talk about too, because this location is an iconic Hollywood location. I watched Stall this movie with my dad recently. I can't remember the name of it, but it's one of those houses that is like they're shooting there constantly. Like they're renting out that house to location. Like
it's a historic two landmark, productions. Like national.
Yeah, exactly. So like it's just one of those locations that like if you're lucky enough to shoot there at some point, it's a blast to be in. This shot in particular feels like something they came up with because of the location. Like possibly something that was like maybe not storyboarded out, but it's just working with the glass on the set. Like it's just that kind of jazz filmmaking of like, these are the elements that I'm given, this is how much time I have, and like this is an efficient way to get this scene through and this feeling across. And this is one of those shots that to me just feels like somebody kind of just in that fucking zone, like it just doing some jazz with this. And I'm wrong. Like maybe that. This was like storyboarded out, but this is just a really excellent use of the location that they're shooting in for sure.
I love that a lot. Sort of embracing the environment, like you said, like we can shoot through all these different surfaces. So like creating this sequence, that's really funny. His invasion of privacy, him kind of like trying to piece all of it together as it's happening.
Yeah,
that's really really funny. Combo of craft. I think in terms of the big budget effects and the grandeur, the spirit of this. We brought up like the ship leaving the dock as being an example of this. And I think that's probably the superior example, at least that's the example that I relate to the most. The cousin of that would be the gelatin space flight that Tim takes. Cause I think him sort of, and I guess I would just wanted a little bit more of that. Like the actors, like, faced with the anomaly of all this and the grandeur of all this, and so when the roof fucking, you know, unfolds and he's like looking out into space and he's just awestruck with all this and then fucking launches in, you know, to the black hole, like all of that I think was really really cool in terms of like the conceit, like capitalizing on the premise, like really kind of giving you the bits of what you like came for. And I think the visual effects, I could even tell, for at least at the time, I think it looked pretty solid. Like, I think that the effect of him being covered in gelatin and flying off looks, you know, a solid for 99. This is where some of the self-aware thing I wanted to just be turned up a notch. And knowing Tim's character at this point, Jason Nesmith, has these, you know, self...
What an awful name.
Has these sort of insecurities about himself. Like, I wanted to play up why does, you know, I need to stay behind and be the hero. I need to rip off my shirt in this moment to feel more masculine, to feel more... Like, I needed them to be more self-aware, because the way that they were happening, it was a little sloppy. Like Alan Rickman's telling him, like, you don't need to be the hero. There's enough room. Like, and he's, like, hunched over the ball, but just for some reason we cut, and he's, like, off of it again. It felt like, as a director, we weren't establishing... There just wasn't clear enough.
Just too much hand to the writer.
The bits weren't clear enough and weren't cohesive enough. It's just, and then it felt like we were cutting it to shreds. Like, we had this whole plan to get the bowl and look out for the monsters, but then we needed to also just clear space so that we could just get him to run with it. So the scene is cut so odd. So he's like, everyone, and then he's like, they're everywhere, but then they're only behind them, and it was just so
odd. They don't catch up for some reason.
So I'm watching, so I'm watching this scene, I'm just like, none of this really makes, and I feel like you say the writer's hand to, like, we just got to get Tim out here with the rock monsters so that the rock monster can destroy the bad guys at the end of the, like, we need to teleport the bad guy at the end so that we can get the mass
set up
army
this,
of,
this
you know
premise,
what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I hear you guys. I definitely hear you guys. And this is 2026 lens, so I'm like, I've had 30 some odd years to sort of ingest some of this storytelling and see how people have pushed this a little further. So again, I got for 99. They were cooking for 99. they were doing their thing for 99. But now I'm in 2026. I'm like, oh, I see how I can punch that up even a little clearer. And I wanted Tim to feel self-important and like give a reason for why he's tearing off his shirt in this moment to like feel like, and like that being the laugh other than it just happening so unnaturally. And so it's like, that felt like a behind the scenes thing that Tim needed to happen. And rather I needed that screen, like I needed that to be
well,
on the page.
I think it's
like,
taking the piss out of William Shatner, but I agree though.
Please.
I think it needed to go one way or the other. It needed to be more of, like, his character finding an excuse to get his shirt off, mm-hmm. or be a little bit cleaner of a way that it happens.
Yeah.
So that it's more plausible that it happened accidentally. Yeah. Or, you know, or like no one else sees it happen and they all like,
if it kept happening
like three times where it's like his shirt.
Why
just
are we
keeps...
not writing this movie? Why are we not writing the sequel to this movie? Like, that's amazing.
It's like every
that
time the sci-fi door like closes shut like an aperture behind him, it keeps catching the tail of his shirt and just ripping it off, and they're just like, come on man, again,
right? Like, that's a good bit. Like, I needed, like, you guys, there's so many things to do. I felt like there was, but anyway, would I press play on this again? I like its successors. I like the children of Galaxy Quest. I like what it represents. Seeing all the faces really fun. Like, seeing a really early Rainn Wilson out of for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun.
One line.
Yeah. The Coke bit. And that scene is gold, too. I actually said the limo, them in the limo and all their interaction and her voice modulator not working and all that kind of shit. Like,
I'm going to close my eyes, but I'm listening to all of this. Yeah. And it's just good primo douchebag shit.
Yeah, that all works.
This is I don't like come back to revisit it myself very often, but mm-hmm. this is definitely something that, like, if I was at a family gathering and I needed to put on something, I would throw this on. Because, like, who's going to get mad?
Yeah.
A little bit of cleavage, the kids will survive. It'll be a formulative memory for them. And they won't be weird about it later. It's fine.
I also wanted to mention here that we're at the tail end of this. I know why I might have missed this, too. I saw the year before, Lost in Space was huge. age. I don't know if that ever came across you. So I remember, at least, not that I remember, because I actually watched the trailer a little earlier this week. I'm like, damn, I remember Lost in Space, but I didn't remember it like I thought I did because none of it looked familiar. The only thing that definitely, like, when my mind was like, oh, I definitely remember that was fucking The Mass, like the whatever, I can't remember.
That effect where Joey's mask.
This day, that still looks awesome. I watched a trailer earlier this week, and then the mash, I was like, I fucking remember that, and it still looks good. Like, so for whatever reason, I think maybe Lost in this is in the wake of that. This weekend was huge. Like, we brought up this Stuart Little, I want to say Toy Story. I can't remember. There's another big film that weekend. It got Jeffrey Katzenberg and DreamWorks input
in. It's 99, man. There was a shitlot of fucking crazy movies coming out.
Yeah, there we were used the to Matrix make wake movies, of this. Man. Yeah. it used to be a stacked weekend of films to see. So I could see it getting lost in that wake, and me, you know, I just, because I completely, when you brought this up, I thought this was the Lost in Space. I was like, was Tim Allen, was that the Lost in Space thing that I remember? And I had to differentiate those as we were carrying through. But yeah, I am glad I saw it. I'm glad to, because this is big with a certain cult fandom. Like, Star Trek people love this movie. Like, they voted this into whatever the list of Star Trek movies are, the definitive list. JJ brings it up several times during this Star Trek making of. And
yeah, all of the, like, OG, like Sir Patrick Stewart, I think fucking George Takei, William Shatner have all been like, fuck this movie, but also this movie is perfect.
They love, and I think it's because it captures that early fandom experience. If I want to, the grace that I want to pass it, I think for whatever reason, we just hadn't gotten there yet. Or just like, there are people that really love this, that are characters too. And if you just kind of turn the camera from the actors to the people that are getting to sign their one sheets, like, they're, there's some pretty funny characters. That was Galaxy Quest. Glad to have seen it. McGee, I got something coming up for you for Inside Baseball, our month of films on films. You ready for it, brother?
Oh, I'm ready.
Coming this March to video stores everywhere.
So I think you know the pick. Obviously, you know the pick.
I mean, I didn't look up anything about it because I know the... Yeah.
Okay.
We hadn't decided how the game worked post... in the new world with our new
with the
show bills.
Hope you guys are enjoying those, because we did release sort of the content calendars or schedule to sleep with
to sleep with anger.
No. Hollywood Shuffle, I'm bringing it up because we talked about Robert Townsend in our To Sleep With Anger episode as being a disciple of Charles Burnett in terms of independent filmmakers kind of going out there, black independent filmmakers going out there, shooting their own work. This is a really interesting Hollywood, black Hollywood story. A Hollywood story, but specifically, you know, Robert Townsend's experience, and that independent Kev Smith, Robert Rodriguez putting everything on a credit card and making a film and just hoping everything works out. It's kind of the lore behind this. So I'm curious, what do you know about 1987's Hollywood Shuffle? Or what do you think we're going to play our Guess the Log Line here. What do you think Hollywood Shuffle's about?
Well,
and the poster, I'll go ahead and spoil. Oh, wait.
Yeah, so what do I know about Hollywood Shuffle is absolutely fucking nothing. cannot lie. Did not know this movie existed until you let me know that it was your pick for this month. So I'm looking at a poster here. It's is that Robert Townsend, the main character, sticking his head through?
Yeah.
So he's got his head through the slate, smiling, big old sunglasses. There's also a like classic painted... depiction along the bottom of the poster. Looks like him running with an Oscar in one hand and a film reel in the other, while a crowd chases him with like guns and picket signs. So, okay.
1987's Hollywood Shuffle.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, Inside Baseball, movies on movies, this is already, you know, looking like somebody, the rise and fall of a filmmaker in Hollywood. I'm going to say more specifically, somebody struggling through the bit shit parts that are offered to Black American actors in, what is this, 90s?
87, so like late 80s.
87, so late 80s, yeah. Early 90s. So it's, you know, it's telling the story of an up-and-coming actor kind of struggling through the shit parts that are offered to a minority in Hollywood in the late 80s. And then him reaching success, making some, you know, hitting the pinnacle of fame, and then absolutely committing to something that absolutely bombs and just, you know, bankrupts a fucking major studio, just like full on fucks everything up, and everybody blames him for everything dissolving, even though it's like, well, your success shouldn't be tied to one movie. But it's yeah, that's the specific rise and fall of the character in this movie.
We continue our streak of needing to rewrite some of these films in our OnlyFans productions. We'll add this to the slate. Because I'm going to be honest with you, couple things. You're not going to love this film. I can already project like your reaction to it. And I think you gave it even more meat on the bone than the film itself. Because you're 100% right, but it's a lot more scaled down than how yeah. you presented a whole cohesive narrative in like a rise and the fall. I'll go ahead and read the log line. Hollywood Shuffle. So here's a log. I believe this is, I want to say, coming from Wikipedia, so forgive me. I think there's maybe a better... believe this is coming from Wikipedia. Hollywood Shuffle is a 1987 American satirical comedy film about the racial stereotypes of African Americans in film and television. And essentially, it's just built off of like a series of vignettes of actors sort of contemplating taking a role that embarrasses, you know, the African American okay. community. But the creativity... First off, it's the chutzpah of getting a fucking thing done. We just talked to Max last week. We know what yeah. climate we're in. It's kind of like one of those, like, he got a thing done. And I'm not trying yeah, to parry yeah. that. Like, there's some amazing bits in it. There's some amazing vignettes in it. But I like almost your version. Like, if I were writing this, that would be the story we tell, essentially, is what yeah, you just spit yeah. out there. Like, the more cohesive narrative, it's going to be a little
less
cohesive.
I like an experimental vignette-y thing, though. Yeah, like, that's the feature-length, like, yeah, right, big right. arc, which is more traditional.
I will say what's fun about this, I want to say it's only 87 minutes, so that's going to hit. It's a nice, nice and quick. You can pick up Hollywood Shuffle on Tubi for free, on Pluto for free. I believe it's available on YouTube for free as well, but if you have Amazon Prime Video, it's there for a higher quality copy. This is a classic 87 response to what Black actors were going through during that time, and Robert Townsend put his all into it. Really fun, funny film that we're going to talk about next week. Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by SoulSpy. Coming soon, folks. Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by SoulSpy. Coming soon, folks.